This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of January 1st, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 271, and Happy New Year. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And the big deal feature, the MMA panel. I'm joined by Mario Canseco of Research Co. and Andy Yan of the Simon Fraser University City Program to look ahead at some of the big stories of 2023. But first, a tribute to the great Pelé. Pelé's soccer legacy was felt in Vancouver. Edson Arantes do Nascimento, one of the greatest athletes of all time, died December 29th at age 82. The three-time World Cup champion played an instrumental role in opening Canadian and American eyes to the beautiful game in the 1970s during three seasons with the North American Soccer League's New York Cosmos. Pelé played twice in Vancouver with Santos of Brazil in 1971 and 1972, and three times with the Cosmos from 1975 to 1977. He also appeared at the 1975 BC Sports Hall of Fame induction banquet and in 1992 at the CONCACAF Under-20 World Championship qualifying tournament at Swangard Stadium in Burnaby. A man of average height from humble beginnings who was a magician with the ball, he dazzled Vancouverites on several occasions at Empire Stadium and inspired many of us to play the game and imagine that we were wearing his number 10. I had the thrill of meeting Pelé when I was a child. My father was on the Whitecaps radio team at CJOR, and then as a young reporter when he appeared as a MasterCard spokesman at a convention in Vancouver. I dropped everything while covering the Beijing 2008 Olympics to attend his photo op outside the Forbidden City. I wasn't the only one disappointed that Pelé didn't light the cauldron at the Rio 2016 opening ceremony in legendary Maracanã. He was reportedly in ill health. But his footprints were already in the stadium, along with the ball that he used to score his 1,000th goal. Artifacts in the museum that is the shrine to Brazil's football triumphs that I first visited during the 2007 Pan American Games. I'll never forget the day that he smiled on Vancouver's side of the pitch at Soccer Bowl 79 in New Jersey, broadcast live across North America on Wide World of Sports on ABC.
It doesn't matter how many years go by, there is always a standing ovation when this man walks on the soccer field, particularly here in the metropolitan New York area. The great Pelé, the most famous player in the history of the game. He's come out for a ceremonial kickoff to begin the proceedings here in Soccer Bowl 79. The man who, in many ways, put the sport of soccer on its way in the United States, coming here in the twilight of his career to play 3 years for the Cosmos. But now it's making it on its own. There it is. All right, gentlemen, now you can play for real. Looks like he's still in pretty good shape, Paul.
I don't think I've ever seen him looking in better shape, as a matter of fact. His non-training must suit him.
90 minutes later, the Whitecaps had beaten Tampa Bay 2-1. Thank you, Pelé. Obrigado. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Just like that, it's the first MMA panel of 2023. It's the sequel to the last MMA panel of 2022. Well, I'm Mackin, and I'm joined by Mario Canseco of Research Co. and Andy Yan of the Simon Fraser University City Program, the MMA panel. We're going to look into our crystal ball and offer some clues of what you can expect in the next 12 months. First, Brenda Locke sent Doug McCallum packing from the mayor's office in the October 2022 civic election in Surrey. Solicitor General Mike Farnworth is now considering the future of policing in Surrey.
Mario, does the RCMP stay the police service of record in Surrey, or does Mike Farnworth say you've gone too far and the Surrey police will become the police service in Surrey? Where do you think Mike Farnworth will go?
I don't think we'll have a decision for the time we tape this podcast at the start of 2024. I think they're going to drag their heels immensely, and they're going to have competing reports, competing budgets. It's not a decision that either of them really wants to make. And it's an issue that galvanizes a very tiny proportion of people. We didn't see a significant level of voter turnout in the election in Surrey. Mm. And we went through a campaign where people were saying, you know, only just over 30,000 people voted for McCallum. So that doesn't give him a mandate to do something like that. And we had a slightly slower number of votes for Brenda Locke. And now they're saying, well, now we have a mandate for change. So it's been interesting to watch everybody who was commenting on McCallum's decisions related to the police doing a bit of a pretzel turn and now saying, well, now we have the mandate that we weren't supposed to be having in order to do something like this. It's very complex for the BC government to get involved in. And part of it is electoral. You know, you don't want to do something that is going to throw off people. This is where Kevin Falcon used to be an MLA. So you don't want to say anything that is going to jeopardize your chances of keeping those seats or even winning new ones. So I think they're just going to continue stalling the matter, trying to figure out if this is the right course of action. But we won't have a decision on what actually will happen in Surrey by the end of next year or this year, 2023.
And I think that that's really going to be, I think one estimate is the $180 million question that I think that this is, I think, some profoundly expensive kind of questions for a place like Surrey to, I think, be facing. But then I think at the same time, I think it really touches upon the struggle of really how Surrey is changing. That, if you will, this kind of element between the last election between Brenda Locke and really McCallum was really, I think, this understanding of really how much Surrey has changed and really how much Surrey is changing and really what's the best way of servicing it. So I think that this is really going to be a question that, I mean, it's going to take some time to fix, but then, you know, still goes into the core issue of how do people feel safe. And I mean, we had talked about really in the year end, really how much public safety is one of the competing issues on the minds of many British Columbians. And in a place like Surrey, it's also up there that if not the top issue that beats out affordable housing, that I think that really this is going to be, I think, something that will probably haunt certainly perhaps the first half of the year as there's back and forth between the internal organizations in the city of Surrey, but then also between the city of Surrey and the province.
All signs point to a recession in 2023 after a year of high interest rates and high inflation in 2022. Governments are building a subway on Broadway, a new Patala Bridge, the sewage plant in North Vancouver, Site C up north, and more projects are on the drawing board.
Do you think that there will be a delay, a pause, or cancellation on any project that's happening in BC because of the recession, Mario?
I think there will be. And a part of what is going to make this compelling as well is this might actually work to benefit the governments. If we don't have an early election, either federally or provincially, it allows whoever is going to be the candidate, whether it's David Eby provincially or Justin Trudeau federally, to come in and do the cutting, the ribbon cutting ceremony for the Arbutus line and go, hey, you know, this is something that happened because we wanted to do it. So in a way, the delays are going to help the governments if they want to promote themselves. But it's also part of the complexity of just how long these projects take and how those assumptions are always made in a situation that is easier to grasp for the taxpayer. And we may not have a full accounting of everything that is going to go through with this until the end. And that is going to be problematic, but it's not going to stop the politicians from cutting ribbons and saying, we delivered. Of course, we had to deal with the pandemic and the situation in Ukraine. But here we are, and this is what we promised, albeit a little bit later than what was supposed to happen.
This is an expanding province, an expanding region, and there's going to be more stress on it in years to come because of immigration patterns. The federal government wants to raise the ceiling on immigration to about 500,000 immigrants per year starting in 2025.
Yeah, I do agree with Mario that I think the ones that are underway are going to be built. They're already going to kind of go in through the slings and arrows of finance and kind of be built. But then the ones that are on the table, I think, may take a bit of time. It may be gearing down or really geared to another pace until I think the scene is a lot more stable in terms of finance, particularly when it comes to interest rates, labor, and materials. But I think going back to the question of immigrants, of 100,000 new immigrants coming into the country, it really does go into not only the getting that number into the country, but it's also the supports we're willing to give, that it isn't just about getting people into this country, but to ensure that they have the instruments to success, that we have the avenues of economic and cultural and social integration, I think, through which is the big question, that as much as the federal government controls the numbers and the process through which this population is allowed into the country, it's also making sure that communities across the country have the tools for success in terms of immigrant integration, in terms of language, in terms of really the skills recognition, the process through which we are going through and getting this population, I think does see a level of well-educated professionals coming into the country who end up driving cabs because of the fact that their credentials aren't recognized. They don't have quote-unquote Canadian experience, and then at the same time are facing what is effectively a hostile economic and housing environment. So that I think that this also goes back to the federal government to say that if you let this population, the number of this population come in, you must have the types of supports to ensure their success.
Do you think that there is any possibility that this Olympic bid might get resurrected, especially now the IOC is giving countries extra time to come up with bids for 2030? Do you think that there's any possibility, or are they wasting their time?
Well, it's just like any other process where you issue a request for qualification. If you extend the deadline, it means nobody wants it. And I think this is part of the problem that the IOC is dealing with at this stage. They got used to a lot of people participating and searching opportunities and making sure that this was something that was of interest to specific levels of government. And BC is clearly not interested in this. We tracked perceptions on the bid, and they started to drop right before the involvement of the four First Nations. And then they tracked upwards a little bit. The last time we asked, we had a majority who said the government made the right decision. In a way, this was done in order to shield David Eby from the criticism. You know, this is announced in the latter stages of the Horgan tenure. Thank you. No, we don't think this is the right course of action. And this happens right after Ken Sim gets elected mayor of Vancouver, when he said, you know, maybe this is something we would like to look into very directly. So it was a very clear message that, you know, they don't want Ken Sim talking about this because, you know, it's not his lane. But also, there's not going to be a lot of support, or any support for that matter, from the provincial government. So going back on this, especially for somebody like David Eby, who has been talking about housing and who has to deal with all of these other concerns, including healthcare, is not something that I think is going to happen. It would certainly throw off the base because many of them were quite happy with the fact that the Olympic bid had been abandoned.
Are there too many other factors that are saying no to this, especially the healthcare crisis?
I think that it's mixed into that question. But then I think in addition to the four host nations, you got to remember there are more than 200 other distinct nations in British Columbia, I think, through which I think the connections towards direct benefits are, I think, still need to be there. That I think that there are ongoing on reserve and off reserve issues that I think also, I think, fit into the question of reconciliation and decolonization. I think that it all comes together towards is the Olympics really, you know, and the legacy and the history of the Olympics really something that you really think is an instrument towards getting the agenda of reconciliation and decolonization onto the table, or is it a distraction? That there are, I think, other realms through which we need to pursue in terms of healthcare, in terms of reforms, in terms of how Canadian society operates economically, socially, and culturally, that that money that would be spent on the Olympics would be better focused on. And I think that this is really, I think you also have to remember that for the housing that was generated from the 2010 Olympics, a minute amount of that was actually affordable. That the other side of it was that it actually helped generate some of the most expensive condominiums in the city. So that the idea of this generating affordable housing is a distraction, because you just largely look at the housing that was created in the 2010 Olympics. A tiny amount was affordable, much less adequate for the kind of growing city and the growing region that Metropolitan Vancouver is entering.
Do you think that David Eby will call an election early in 2023 or and tempt fate against Kevin Falcon and the BC Liberals? Or do you think he'll hold off until 2024? Mario?
I think he holds off. A couple of reasons for that. One of them is we have the Alberta election happening at roughly the same time as an early election in BC would take time, would take place. And there's a lot of people who are organizers for the party here who will certainly travel to Alberta and try to make some phone calls and get Rachel Notley reelected. So you lose that opportunity if you have some of your people working in a different province. It's also not absolutely necessary. I could understand why in 2020, the NDP decided to go for it. They had very high ratings related to the COVID-19 pandemic. They had an extremely weak BC Liberal leader in Andrew Wilkinson, who was being helped by people who did not do a fantastic job. And this is one of the reasons why they had such a dismal level of votes. And it's also complex for the BC Liberals. I don't think they want an early election either because they're in the middle of a rebrand. If you have an election in May of next year, you don't have time to implement all of the changes. And I think there will be a lot of people out there who are considering running for the new BC United who will be happy to do that in 2024, but not necessarily running as a BC Liberal candidate in 2023. So you still have to deal with the baggage of the party. And I think this is one of the reasons for them to be talking about this as something that could be possible. But I don't think either David Eby wants this because he's going to go back on his promise. And I don't think Kevin Falcon wants this either because he would be forced to run as a BC Liberal again. And this is not something he wants to do.
I think for now, it's going to be when those 100 days of action show results and what those results are going to be. And yet, at the same time, I think that the results are not going to be, I think, in the spring. I think that, if anything, I do agree with Mario. I think that there's going to be, I think, the fact that the election will probably be in 2024. I think there's a question of really what is there to gain. I mean, one can argue that this is a point through which this is the high point. Everyone's in a honeymoon period with really a new premier, really the role of a surplus in the budget, a sense of, I think, in a certain type of optimism when you have a new leader coming into play. I think that really, but then at the same time, I think that I think folks are tired. I think that, you know, there are so many issues locally, provincially, nationally, globally, that is draining off of individuals that you don't want to necessarily, I think, trigger a reaction of opportunism in a way that I think really, I think, again, gives people a reason to vote you out. And so I think that this is, I think, really, I think, following a pace through which David Eby and his government sets themselves up as why they should be government, which I think it's different from the kind of vote them out risk that, say, Trudeau is facing. That if anything, this is not the John Horgan NDP, this is the David Eby NDP. And I think that really how much that is also now part of a generational change, that if you look at who he put in government, who he put in cabinet positions, key cabinet positions. I think they present really a generational change, I think, which is really interesting, just as much as I think the opposition, the Liberals themselves are, I think, themselves trying to kind of pivot themselves towards BC United, which I still think is a football team, but that really touches upon really actually it's non-desire for a election too. So I think between all that, I think that there will be an election when it is supposed to happen, as opposed to an early one.
You are listening to the MMA panel's 2023 forecast. Guests Mario Canseco of Research Co. and Andy Yan of the Simon Fraser University City Program are joining me to look into the crystal ball.
Do you think that we could be seeing a federal election in 2023? Or do you think Justin Trudeau would also look at his future? Here's someone who has declining popularity. Right. He's gone through three elections.
Right.
There might be some fatigue with Justin Trudeau in his own house.
I don't think it happens either. As much as I love elections, covering them, doing surveys on them, figuring out how people will vote, it's too risky for Jagmeet Singh to pull the plug and to say, the Liberals didn't give us what we hoped they were going to give us. Vote for us and we'll get a majority and we'll get everything that we promised. It's not the same type of situation as the one that, let's say, Jack Layton had in 2011, when it was easy to go out there and convince people, you don't want Michael Ignatieff as your prime minister, and you don't want to vote for him either. So support us. And this is how the NDP got to second place. It's also very complicated for them because the junior partners in coalition agreements, or however we want to call them, alliances, are usually the ones that suffer. And there's no better example than the Liberal Democrats in the United Kingdom, who end up winning more than 60 seats the first time. And then, you know, they form this coalition government with the Conservatives. And then when the next election rolls around, they are reduced to less than 10 seats. So the junior partner gets none of the credit, and they end up getting decimated at the end. So if this is an election that is triggered because Jagmeet Singh is not happy with what Justin Trudeau is doing, he's not going to be the beneficiary of all of those votes. If anything, people are going to be upset with what happens. And it doesn't necessarily help the Conservatives either. So I think they're better off trying to figure out how to take this to the next level, wait it a little bit longer, and not necessarily forcing their issue to try to topple them. It's in Jagmeet Singh's hands, of course. Yeah. But we've seen the numbers in every election that that he has contested. His approval rating climbs the charts. People like what they see. He is a great debater, and people react very well to what he's saying. But it doesn't mean that all of those people are going to vote for their NDP candidate. So I don't think he gets anything out of it. To become a footnote in a way, as the guy who toppled the government, because it's not going to lead to an NDP majority or even becoming the official opposition.
Is this the best it gets for Jagmeet Singh, being essentially a kingmaker, keeping Justin Trudeau in power?
Well, I think at this point, it's really, what is he not getting in this relationship? It's really, I think, the height for which he actually is probably the kingmaker, one of the most powerful political entities. I mean, we have dental care. Like, one of the major promises that the NDP wanted to make was the fact that you have it's a form of universal dental care. It's still, I think, slowly rolling out. But then I think at the same time, I mean, there's still, of course, the ongoing question about the pharmacare. But then the fact that he was able to kind of have that win, that really the next 2 years can also be also another part of him further developing a further wins, I think, towards his policy platform. And I think fundamentally, it's also, what does he have to lose? I think that really, that really is coming into play. That I think that nobody has anything to win in terms of calling an early election, particularly on the federal basis. Because I mean, you think about Pierre Poilievre, which we talked about. I think in the year end is he's a brand through which is developing. I mean, a brand through which is developing quite interestingly within young people. That I think that's going to be something to watch. But then at the same time, I think that within the Liberals, I think that there's also this kind of history of the fact that, you know, most federal prime ministers don't last beyond three elections. And, you know, now we're entering the we're really entering that that stage right now with the Trudeau. I mean, technically, into the Trudeau administration. So I think that really now, I think, isn't really a time for a federal election. It would be surprising if it would be Jagmeet Singh who would cause a lack of confidence and a federal election, just simply because I think at this point, he's winning to his agenda.
What kind of crazy, wild and crazy prediction might you have for another bureaucratic blunder that happens in 2023? What do you think? And who's going to be at fault? Will it be federal, provincial, municipal? What's going to happen? What do you think it'll be, Mario?
Well, at first, I'd like to say that I'm disappointed that we never got to see the barge covered in snow. That would have been a fun photo op, but you know, it happened much more rapidly than many of us imagined. I think if there's going to be an issue that is going to resonate, it'll be crime. And unfortunately, in the past couple of weeks, we've had instances of criminal behavior in Ontario that has been covered extensively, and we're starting to see criticism towards the provincial authorities, to a lesser extent, to municipal authorities. And of course, because there's so many Conservatives in Ontario, this is all Justin Trudeau's fault. So we might have a similar situation in the Lower Mainland, something big that happens, some big criminal activity where we start to see that level of criticism towards municipal governments, provincial governments, and also the federal government. If there's something there that is going to start to mobilize bases and to try to be used for the advantage of a specific political party, I think that will be it. The other stuff is going to take years. You know, all of the housing developments which are being discussed, we're going to continue to have the same debate we always have, which is BC asking for more money for healthcare and the federal government saying, no, you show me how you spend it. We're bound to have another couple of years of that. But if there's going to be an issue that might move voters from one side to the other, it's going to be related to crime. And sadly, we will have crime stories. We will have a situation where people are going to discuss what happened just a stone's throw away from their houses. So I think that will be the one if there's something that is going to move people.
Well, I think building on what Mario had said, that I think one has to remember that in late November, there was actually a takeover robbery at the Café du Soleil, which unfortunately has also closed, by the way, in the east side of Vancouver, that a few more stories around violent stranger crime, I think, resonates, I think, through which I think has certainly helped change what who was in city in council chambers in the city of Vancouver, that I think similarly could resonate and really have an effect at the provincial and the federal level if these events really happen. Because I think that it's not necessarily one of statistics that I think that I've talked a lot about this, is that it's not one of statistics that, you know, Canadian society, I think even throughout even this period has kind of proven to be really safe, but really the vibe. And that it's not necessarily about the statistics, it's about the vibe and the perception. And that really, as much as any elected official can come out and their kind of research teams come out with statistics of talking about how low violent crime is occurring, that a few examples of these takeover style robberies, hate crimes, of crimes of violence and just stranger on stranger violence, that I think really, I think could change the term. Can you really change the tone of what people are willing to vote for and whom they're going to vote for? So I think that is really one through which I think is disconcerting. I think that, of course, the issue is that, you know, what is the kind of larger, I think, factors towards having this crime occur? Is it about how people are getting more desperate as we look at the cost of living and the lack of economic opportunity, ongoing issues of addictions, as well as really, I think, the desperation that occurs, that I think that it all, I think, culminates towards this level of uncertainty. And I think that this is really something to, I think, watch, because it takes just, unfortunately, the right victim and the right incident through which we can see a sudden change in the forthcoming 2 years for both levels of government, the provincial and the federal governments.
Well, one of the wildcards that I would add is the performance of the police. We saw how the opinions on the RCMP changed after the Jagansky incident at the airport. We know that the police is quite happy with the relationship that it has with the mayor of Vancouver, particularly. So it will be important in an era where everybody has a camera and everything gets recorded, how the police performs in case something like this breaks.
Thanks again for joining me on the Breaker.News podcast. This is another MMA panel. Me, I'm Mackin. I got Mario Canseco from Research Co. We got Andy Yan from the Simon Fraser University City Program. Looking ahead at the next 12 months, it's going to be a wild ride, as it always is. 2023, and we want to hear from you out there, podcast listeners. Bob@thebreaker.news is my email. Send me your predictions and we'll read some of them on air in a future edition of the podcast. Happy, safe, and healthy new year, because of course, public safety and public health, two big issues that we've talked about and we'll be talking about again on the Breaker.news podcast. Happy new year.
Happy new year.
Happy new year.
Time on the Breaker.news podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Taiwan news, Taiwan human rights activist points out two regional front lines battling authoritarianism. Yang Sanhong urges President Tsai Ing-wen to visit Washington. In today's new wave of global freedom and democracy, the front line in the Western Hemisphere is at the border of Ukraine and Russia, Yang said. Meanwhile, the front line in the Eastern Hemisphere is in the Taiwan Strait. Those two areas block the two, quote, evil powers, Russia and China. Yang noted that Legislative Yuan Speaker Yu Si-kun has been invited to give speeches at January's International Religious Freedom and National Prayer Breakfast in Washington, D.C. In Kyoto news, ex-Tokyo Olympic exec in bribery scandal released on 80 million yen bail. Haruyuki Takahashi, 78, was released from the Tokyo detention house on a $603,000 bond after the Tokyo District Court decided earlier in the day that there was no risk of him fleeing or destroying evidence. Takahashi has been accused of accepting bribes through five routes in return for helping companies be selected as a sponsor or a marketing agent of the global event in 2021. Prosecutors have indicted 15 people in connection with the case. In Hong Kong Free Press, Hong Kong law against urging blank votes ruled constitutional. Ex-student leader handed suspended two-month sentence. Jackie So, 23, who was a leader of the defunct Chinese University of Hong Kong Students Union, stood accused of sharing a Facebook post by self-exiled former lawmaker Ted Hui, which allegedly incited others to cast blank ballots in the 2021 Legislative Council elections.
That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Eugene Register Guard, whale watching at the coast. Whale Watch Week kicked off Wednesday in person for the first time since 2019 after being canceled because of the coronavirus pandemic. More than 15 sites along the Oregon coast offer a chance to watch thousands of gray whales migrate south through Oregon's waters through Sunday. In King 5, electric vehicle owners in Bellingham will now have to pay to charge. The city is currently building 45 charging stations in 25 locations spread across Bellingham. With 67,000 electric vehicles, Washington has the second most per capita in the United States, second only to California. Drivers in Bellingham will now pay $2 for a full tank of electricity for an average electric car, plus 75 cents an hour to park. For high-speed charging stations, it's an additional $1 per hour. In Czech news, no weather alerts issued for BC after several weeks of severe conditions. After an onslaught of snow, freezing rain, wind, rain, and more, Environment Canada did not issue any weather alerts for BC on December 28th. It was a relatively calm day in December.
That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone.
The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to
the unsung heroes that got British Columbians through the wild weather during Christmas time. The tow truck drivers, the snowplow drivers, the salting and sanding crews, the meteorologists, the sandbag crews, the Coast Guard, the travel agents who found ways for people to get where they needed to go, the hotel managers who looked after stranded travelers.
You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of January 1st, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 1st of January in 1600, Scotland recognized the day as the start of the year, instead of starting the year on March 25th? And in 1947, the Canadian Citizenship Act came into effect. Canadians were no longer British subjects, they were Canadians. Prime Minister William Lyon Mackenzie King became the first Canadian citizen. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit TheBreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. That's patreon.com/TheBreakerNews.
Until next week,
Happy New Year. Should I break that spin?